Thank you so much for that musical offering, Linda Jo. That's a beautiful piece. My name is Linda McPherson, and I'm going to just say a few words to introduce what we have planned for today. We are encouraged as Unitarian Universalists to pursue a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. I view the exercise of looking deeply at our shared past and being willing to consider new perspectives as a key component of that search. And after Dr. Dina Dart's talk a few weeks ago, I was also struck by the juxtaposition of this, our fourth UU principle, with the fourth step of 12-step programs, which she referenced in her talk, which calls for a searching and fearless moral inventory. In my view, the purpose of both of these is to look at our past with openness and honesty, but not to punish or blame. As we take steps in this journey to learn more, as our land acknowledgement statement encourages us to do, it is important to me that we be willing to look hard and critically to deconstruct some of the myths and concepts we have learned about the idea of civilization, the doctrine of discovery, manifest destiny, and the settlement of this country. I have found that by just beginning to develop some awareness around these ideas, it has enabled me to see more clearly in my everyday life the ways in which we have internalized these ideas. For example, as a seventh grader, my daughter Willa's social studies class is beginning the year by looking at the, quote, rise of civilization, which has presented us with opportunities to talk about what does that word and that concept really mean? What constitutes civilization? So often in historical narratives, Indigenous peoples are depicted as uncivilized. Why is that? In addition, my husband Bruce and I recently did a short backpack trip to the Indian Heaven Wilderness area in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest, which is in Washington. And I wondered, where does that name come from? And why is it called that? It is clear from the little bit that I've learned about what happened there with Indigenous peoples, that there was a significant amount of civilization centered in those spaces. Today's service is inspired by an idea that I shared with all of you at the end of August about one of my big takeaways from attending the 2020 UUA General Assembly. My thought then was to invite you all to join me in reading this book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States for Young People. I suggested the young people adaptation because I thought it would be more achievable for all of us, possibly even some of our young people. And after that August service, a number of you reached out to me expressing interest in this idea. Today, we're going to hear from some of those folks as they offer some brief reflections after reading just the introduction. Like, all we've done is dip our toe in, just the introduction to this book. And I so appreciate their willingness to share deeply and thoughtfully. We're going to hear from, in this order, M.A., Deborah, Ari, and Barbara Dow.
I grew up in Plymouth County, Massachusetts, Plymouth Rock and all that. So as a kid, if I learned anything about the colonial history of this country, it had mostly to do with the pilgrims, the settlers, not about the people they displaced. I don't know if I remember learning anything about the Indians who lived here. And as far as I knew, nothing of theirs existed, except maybe some place names, like Massachusetts itself, which is an Algonquin word meaning the land about the great hills, referring to what are now known as the Blue Hills, just south of Boston. It wasn't until I was an adult that I became aware there are Indians still living in Massachusetts, 37,000 according to the 2010 census, which isn't large, but it's not nothing either. And there are smallish settlements of Native people as well, some of which, as you might imagine, are still having to contend for their right to exist even today. And also, Columbus Day was celebrated as a big deal back east, bigger than here. We learned the standard myths about this explorer, but nothing about the extermination of the Taino people of what are we now call the Caribbean. Yet things are changing as to the history that is told. I looked it up and found that there are now 6 municipalities in the state of Massachusetts that celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day rather than Columbus Day. Regarding how we relate to Indigenous People Day here in Oregon, two of the things I love about YEAST are that it's a place I get educated and it's a place I take action. For example, our congregation was one of only 6 in the country that got in on the ground floor of having the Unitarian Universalist Association pass a resolution to repudiate the doctrine of discovery, the 500-year-old church law that justified Europeans taking native lands. That strong resolution was passed at the 2012 UUA General Assembly. And here we are again with more opportunities to learn and to act as a result of our having Indigenous peoples as the YE social justice focus for the year. We'll hear from 5 speakers on the subject and connect with 8 or so Native organizations doing good work that we can support through our special collections. These are some of the expected ways we can do something with our awareness this year. But then again, I always notice that once you open that door, there are other ways as well. Like just this week, I got an invitation from the only Native American in the Oregon House of Representatives, Tana Sanchez, whose district is just west and mostly north of us at the Senior Center. Her virtual event is supporting Multnomah County Ballot Measure 26214, Preschool for All. And I'm forwarding her invitation to all of us today. Wouldn't it be neat if a bunch of us YEasters showed up online to support Representative Sanchez in her work? Because in my experience, it's one thing to start off in life as unaware and unconnected as the system intends for us to be. It's another to stay that way by our own choice.
Thank you, MA. I don't know that you left anything else for me to say, but I'll say it anyway. Hi, this is Deborah. As many of you know, I grew up in Minnesota, right on the South Dakota border, which is 40 miles from the Lake Traverse Reservation, 100 miles from Pipestone, Minnesota, 167 miles from Mankato, where President Lincoln had 38 Dakota hanged for killing 490 white settlers in a Sioux uprising. You would think I would be steeped in knowledge, understanding, and horror. Not the case. All I knew were the stereotypes, which were all negative. I also grew up 104 miles from Walnut Grove, Minnesota, and 113 miles from DeSmet, South Dakota. As any fans of Laura Ingalls Wilder will recognize as homes that she had on the prairie. At one time, I knew everything about those books and those places and the Indians who came and visited the little houses during different times and the fear that Laura had of Indians. I took great pride in thinking about how my people came from Europe and had similar stories when they settled in Minnesota. When our daughter Justice was little, I was going to joyfully reread to her the whole series. I picked up the first book and I couldn't get past the first chapter. All of the barriers in my mind that had prevented me from seeing the obvious truths came crashing down about those books, and I out the door. I also listened at 1.2 This American Life which I love, This American Life, and they had a story about the Little War on the Prairie that told the story from the other side of what that Dakota uprising was about and how really horror-filled and unfair and all of that the hanging was. As we know, history is written by the winner. That's how we learn the stories. A friend of mine that I grew up with since second grade and am still in constant contact with, and I were talking about white supremacy, not as it related to Indians and Indigenous peoples, but more about Black people. We had no Black people in our rural community, but we knew through insidious and other very powerful ways that we were white and we were supreme to all other people. We never talked about it. It was unspoken, but it was sometimes hinted at by names we called other races, about stories we told. It was not uncommon for us to hear stories of another poor drunken Indian found frozen to death on the side of a highway. We gave them so much, they did little with it, and they just, you know, they just weren't getting it together. Now, as we're growing up as a nation and understanding things like generational trauma, etc., we have a lot to unlearn, relearn, and learn anew. I'm really looking forward to learning more together by reading this book together, because I find that when you read books together, it pulls out experiences that other people have and helps you move forward at a faster rate. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Hi, my name is Ari. Hopefully this is working. So when I read the introduction to an Indigenous people's history of the United States, my primary takeaway was that we need to change the way we teach history, or at least the way most of us learned history. So my wheels started spinning about what that might look like, making me wonder, what should the goals of history class be? I'm sure history teachers think about this often, as I did for science when I taught that, but I hadn't given the history question a whole lot of thought before. Why do we teach young people the history of the United States? I'll be curious to hear different thoughts on this. My eighth grade history teacher told us to honor the work that brought us here and to avoid making the same mistakes of the past. That made sense to me, and it still does. There's also the fact that public education is a government-sponsored program that tries, perhaps with good intentions, to instill some degree of patriotism and conformism to make us all into good, successful citizens. Minus the conformism, I actually like all three of these purposes: to honor the work that brought us here, to avoid the same mistakes, and to foster successful citizens. But we have to revisit what each of those means. Honor whose work? Those who look like us? Those who won? And where is here exactly? Where have we been brought? And are we content with this? What constitutes a mistake? How can we identify a mistake without hearing every perspective? Are we to judge historical actions from our current context or a historical context? From the majority perspective or an individual's perspective? And what on earth is a successful citizen? Sadly, sometimes I think blissfully ignorant ones are the best off, but let's not go there. To me, a successful citizen is somebody who knows that their story is one of millions, their perspective one of millions. In this context, they develop the skills to listen, share, and search for real improvement for themselves and others. Therefore, I think history class should be filled with more stories and fewer facts. Stories from rich people, poor people, Black people, brown people, different genders, ages, abilities, religions. The history of the United States should abound with stories from Indigenous people. I'm hungry to learn some, and I'm hopeful that this book shares multiple different narratives from Indigenous people. Because one of my fears is that in our quest to understand those who are different from us, we will categorize their stories with representative samples. It's what we humans do to make sense of the world. It's not our fault, but we better be aware of it if we want to avoid its shortcomings, namely emphasizing differences and reinforcing stereotypes. Hardly any of us fit neatly into the classic categories anyway. My daughters, Marielle and Canela, are descendants of English, Germans, Spanish Mexicans, Native Mexicans, and others. I want the history they learn to help them make sense of that, but also to empower them to know that their views are their own to write. Stories are for helping us make sense of the world, but they are also for showing us that the world makes different sense to each one of us. We can never hope to know another person's full perspective, but we can listen to as many stories as possible. And before we jump to categorize them, hear them as the individual memories from the individual beings that they are. I look forward to reading the stories in this book and hearing countless more from people themselves. Thank you. I invite Barbara Dow.
Good morning. I'm Barbara Dow. I grew up in Salem, Oregon. For those who haven't met me, I hope to meet you soon. When I first started deciding what to talk about, I looked at some of the ideas that Linda had sent us. And I thought what I would do is jot down my first reaction and look at it after reading this book. Like Ariana, I really look forward to learning more partly because the first question was, why is it important to read and understand more of this history? And I immediately thought, well, because I didn't really learn much in school, and that kind of relates to what Ariana was just talking about. The more I thought about it, the more I felt that was kind of strange, because that history is much closer in time than a lot of things we did learn in history class. Most of the interesting developments and challenges happened within 100 years of when I was born. And in terms of geography, it's even closer. You know, I feel kind of close to the land, especially the Wallawa, which we've kind of almost touched on, because that's where Chief Joseph's band, the Nez Perce, spent much of this summer. And my mother taught me that was special place. And I know it's special to quite a few Wyeesters as well. I remember going to the grave of old Chief Joseph when I was a young person. And I also thought about the second question, which Linda McPherson kind of touched on, which is the concepts and broader themes of the book. I look forward to learning some of those. I'm sure they'll be different. In the introduction, which is the only part I've read so far, there was quite a lot of talk about civilization. And to me, it seemed like the land was the bigger piece, or a big piece of civilization. And that the settlers had a very different concept of the land than did the native people who lived here when the settlers arrived. And so I'm looking forward to learning more about land as we go through. The idea of property is another one that is sort of a preconception of the white Europeans. and probably thought of very differently by the communities that were subjugated by us as settlers. And that also it's almost a natural connection. And the third thing I thought about is relationships. I remember a relational interview that somebody from the MACG in Portland had with me maybe 25 years ago. Probably many of you shared that experience. And I remember I must have been in my late 30s or early 40s at the time. I remember thinking, yes, but there isn't really time to develop relationships. And my friend had been learning in the MACG, and it came more naturally to her, perhaps, that you need to have a relationship before you can work on social change or any kind of an issue. And for a long time, I didn't hear much about that. And then in the last few years, it seems like it's been coming up quite a bit in different groups that I've been in contact with or worked with. And I think people are realizing more that relationships is such an important thing in terms of supporting, fueling, and for its own sake, existing in any social related thing that we do. And I've been particularly struck by the idea of relationship with the land. Before, when we were talking about relationship within the context of social groups of various kinds, I think my understanding was it was mostly about people. And I think it's very important, our understanding and developing relationships with people. But a very interesting book I read recently, and probably many of you have, called Braiding Sweetgrass by a woman who has Native Indigenous connections and roots, talks about quite a bit about relationship with the land and the vegetation and even the inanimate parts of the land. The water is important, and the land itself, as well as the animals like us, and animals that aren't so much like us, and plants, and the relationship of all of those together on the earth. So she talks about those quite a bit in the book Braiding Sweetgrass, and I look forward to reflecting closely on these experiences as I read the book with, hopefully with several of you or by myself, whatever. I did buy it, and it'll be fun to go into the future with all these perspectives. I did jot down some ideas to look at afterwards, and maybe I'll carefully craft a talk. This one isn't carefully crafted. I threw out what I had written at 10 o'clock this morning. So I appreciate your patience in listening to my ramblings or what emerged when I started with these different ideas and kind of put them together. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Barbara and MA and Linda Jo and Ari and Deborah for sharing your thoughts and reflections with us this morning. It takes a certain amount of courage to come forward and share in this way. And I so love hearing from you and appreciate your willingness to do that. I hope some of you might be inspired to try it in the future. I also hope that some of you are inspired by the idea of joining a monthly discussion group around this book. I'll hold it up again so you can remember what the cover looks like. There are like 28 copies at the Multnomah County Library. Only a couple of them are currently available, but there are multiple copies available there. It's available for purchase through the UUA bookstore, if you wanted to support the UUA bookstore in that way. And I'm hopeful that we might make the second Sunday of the month, maybe in the late afternoon or so, a monthly gathering time for those who are interested in reading this book and talking about what we can learn moving forward. If you're really into like a more advanced version, there is a regular version of this book as well, which is like 500 plus pages and contains a lot more. Both are good possibilities. I'm really moved by how much connection we can build with one another through a shared experience, like reading a book together and learning together. And how it can really enrich our spiritual and social life while also moving forward our shared vision for creating more justice in the world. And so I look forward to sharing that journey with all of you. I'm going to close and turn things back over to Lana calling back to the words of Amanda Udis Kessler, the composer of Linda Jo's musical offering. And I hope that the reflections you heard today have both pushed you and moved your heart. May you be well, and I look forward to seeing you in a monthly discussion group.
Thank you so much.